Les colloques du Collège de France.
Justin comes from the EMBL in Heidelberg and he's going to explore the evolutionary limits of transcriptional enhancers. Justin.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to shift gears quite a bit here, obviously, hopefully shake it up a little bit. So I'm going to walk you through today a bunch of it's already published to kind of bring everybody up to the same frame. Then we have a lot of unpublished work and kind of future directions. This, for us, would be kind of fun, I thought. So right away, obviously, the gears we're shifting is because I'm focusing on this system right here, which is very obviously not a vertebrate system, as we've been focusing on so far. And the reason for that is I can skip these very quickly right now, because I think this has been covered extensively at this point, which gets me right into why we care about this, right? So I personally don't really care about disease that much, but I have to sell the talk every now and then. What I really care about is this component right here, the evolutionary side of these things, right? This is because we know enhancers do all these beautiful things across these different systems, right? We have like the prefrontal cortex evolution. We have things like the placenta, right? These entirely new tissues that have come in, which we know are driven by different change of gene expression patterns. A little closer to home, we have things like the fruit fly pigmentation patterns in this very elegant work. Again, Kingsley's work from sticklebacks, right? We can kind of go on and on with all these very, very elegant examples about how transcriptional changes at these enhancers have actually driven this phenotypical change, right? And aside from that, we've already seen nice examples of these different conditions like, you know, limb patterning. And on top of that, we know, particularly this community here, that the variety of the majority of mutations in human disease actually map to these regions, right? So clearly they're very fundamentally important. So really, since starting my group at EMBL, we've been focused a large degree on this one little piece of this 300 base pairs of DNA. And the reason we're very focused on this, I'll walk you through here, because we're interested in understanding how, very mechanistically, many of the enhancers drive these very precise patterns of expression. Because if you take this enhancer, put it in front of a reporter gene, put it back in, you'll get these very beautiful stripes very reproducibly. Right? So again, you have this very nice textbook view of these transcription factors. I'll sit there, turn this reporter gene on these parts, or these stripes. So I think we're getting pushing very fast ahead in this in the community. I'm hoping Alex will solve a lot of this and talk here. But again, I'll still kind of assert, like, you know, Wendy and many others have already talked about, that really we struggle to predict these enhancers. In other words, if I gave you this piece of DNA, I been focused on this for decades now, and I still cannot really tell you concretely why it's only on those stripes very precisely during development, right? So again, we still have a lot to learn, but I think we're getting a lot closer. And again, we still really struggle even furthermore to predict the effect of mutations, right? This is still something we're struggling with as a community. So the question for me is why, really? And this ends up being, what information are we missing? So when we first kind of took this journey here, we didn't know very simple questions like, if you just kind of randomly went through this enhancer, how many binding sites might there be? How robust are these to perturbations? How evolvable are they? And can we actually put them eventually in a predictive context, again, relating to changes in sequence to changes of gene expression patterns? So the system, if you're not a fly nerd like us, is this kind of ridiculous name here known as Shaven Baby. And the reason why it has this particular name is because what this gene will actually do is, we know from a huge amount of work from Yanni, Eric, many other groups, that many different transcriptional networks, which, you know, they were some of the first ones to identify, all converge on this little gene right here. And this is actually the same piece of enhancers which drives these little stripes here. The reason we're focused on this, and the reason why it's known as a Shaven Baby, is Shaven Baby itself is a transcription factor. And what it'll actually do is turn on these particular cells shown here, which will ultimately turn on and make these little hook-like structures in these little bands here. And really why this is a very powerful system is, again, we can leverage all this background information. And we also know, for example, each one of these little stripes here correspond exactly to these little regions right here. Right? So again, we have all this information now to understand how this might be integrating on this piece of DNA. And for us to kind of really drive that point home, really what these are doing as well, see if I can get this to play on here. So these are those same cells right here, and you can see really, again, what these are facilitating is these kind of just crawling along, right? So I'm not talking about the behavior side today, since there's a lot of the other work in the group. But again, we're focused very much now on using this system to understand, again, how these are actually turning on these particular genes in these very precise patterns. So one of the things I would argue that as a community we've struggled with, now I want to put this kind of in an evolutionary context now. So if you would actually go out, collect huge amounts of variation across the globe for this exact enhancer, and you can actually line them all up, what you see right here, this is actually 273 sequences with very high confidence. And it looks like some variation here, but this is very sparse. Right? We have a handful of changes to the entire enhancer, which means for us, we don't really have a good statistical resolution from this standpoint. Right? So again, limited variation in natural populations. And we know there's many reasons for this, right? There's population size, there's things like contingency, fitness effects. So a lot of what we've been doing to kind of sidestep a lot of that is to kind of really embrace these approaches from synthetic biology. And in this case, what I'm showing you now is an example that I'll walk you through for many outputs of this, because what this is right now is the same sequence in the middle here, but now comparing it to a large library, which I'll walk you guys through. And you can see here, this is about 1,000 lines, and it's a huge amount of sequence variation. Right, so the strength here, again, is now we have new statistical power, because what I can walk you through now is this is actually equivalent to about 60 million years of evolution. And this is not limited anymore by fitness and contingency, because I'm putting this in a reporter construct, and I'm putting all this back in the same spot in the genome. Right? So again, this is really powerful, because it's 60 million possible years of evolution, the same spot in the genome. And to kind of walk you through how we had to get access to this, this is all published, so I'll go through it pretty quickly. But again, this is another way to look at the sequence space. We have this 300 base pair piece of DNA. We have just a random mutation rate throughout this through degenerate PCR. So again, this is very unbiased by any priors. And we made about 1,000 independent lines from these. So, you know, to actually get this pipeline going, we had different transgenic approaches, a lot of robotics to automate the whole process. We have a lot of more machine learning driven approaches for adaptive feedback microscopy to image all of this in a very, you know, clean way. Because really, again, the goal here was not to make this, you know, easy, which is obviously a very nice aspect of it, but it's a very controlled way to understand how changes here on the input side will relate to different outputs. And to cut a very long story short, because again, a lot of this is already published, what I want to show you right now is a quick video. And this is actually now to kind of put this in reference, this is the wild type enhancer right here, right? So you're going to get these very beautiful patterns of expression. And what I'm going to show now is a very manic video, and this is by design, because this is actually going across many of these thousands of lines for each different individual frame. And I think what you'll see, hopefully, very quickly, is that these look radically different than the wild-type enhancer, right? And really what we end up finding by doing any of this, so I can actually pause it, and you can see right there, this looks nothing like that first enhancer I showed you, right? And again, this is me randomly stopping somewhere in this library of enhancers. Because the major thing we end up finding in this is that every single one of these enhancers had a difference in the level of in the expression on the output. And to kind of slow it down and walk you through an example of that right here, you can see again that each one of these is a single nucleotide variant just pulled out randomly from that library. And if you compare these now to that wild type enhancer at the top here, up here, you can see that these are all very, very different. And this is, you know, well borne out in the statistics here. So again, by doing these very, you know, high skill approaches, but again, doing quantification of this, it became very quickly clear that, again, all these mutations are changing the expression, timing, levels, or location. And I'm not going to go through all the details right now, but you can start to see, for example, you can footprint, you know, how important some of these binding sites might be by aggregating all this information. And a lot of the things we can map out now are transcription factor binding sites for things that we've biochemically validated, right? So each one of these highlighted ones here are validated. And we could actually pull out things that were previous ones that took me a huge amount of effort to focus on because they're very non-canonical, very low affinity binding sites, but you can see we can still identify those. And again, the major drive home point for a lot of this is that we don't necessarily know what all these things are binding to us, right? So I'm gonna come back to that maybe at the end if I have time. But again, the important thing here is that these were very dense from an information perspective as we mutated. And I think as someone like actually Wendy, I think we noted this earlier, is that, you know, we're seeing very similar things from a lot of different vertebrate systems as well, and also from, you know, different disease models, right? So this is very conserved across all of these different systems. And again, just to kind of put this, you know, compare it to these cartoon models, this is probably from that information perspective what it might look like, right? And all of these colored ones, the validated binding sites, a lot of these ones are pure speculation because we have no idea what might be binding to them. So initially then, we knew going in this was very information dense, And we were curious that, you know, maybe this is this one weird enhancer, where it oftentimes gets that question. So we were curious in how extensive are these constraints, and what about other tissues or enhancers, right? So then we wanted to kind of go out to other things, at different aspects of development. And the reason we started getting into this then is what we found here, which I still think is a rather striking observation, is that as we are mutating these enhancers across all these different libraries, and I'm pulling out these three different ones right here, what we found very quickly is that by focusing on different tissue types in a kind of gross morphological way, you can now see that ectodermal expression, which is where Shaman B is, right? Because again, it's turning these little hook structures on very precisely in the ectoderm. And as we are mutating across this library and comparing it to different regions in the mesoderm or endoderm, the only changes were in that ectodermal tissue type, right? So we saw no changes actually happening outside of that, which to us was very jarring at the time, and it still arguably is. So you can obviously see that there's different level effects, like I showed you before. You can change different places, like these ring structures, different stripes. You can actually start to turn on wings and halteres, which I'll come back to later on. But again, the important point is that all of these tissues are derived from very similar lineages, right? So just to kind of really jam that point home. And then we're really curious then again how this is shaping evolution in a much broader perspective. So initially, one of the criticisms was to come back to Shaven Baby is if you consider a differentiation going from early to late in kind of this Waddington landscape, Shaven Baby is actually a terminal selector gene. It sits very far at the end. So it could be from, you know, an evolutionary standpoint, something selected for that. So we wanted to see if we saw the very similar trends for mid and early embryogenic enhancers. And so Noah, who is a graduate student currently in the group, did a very similar screen now focusing on this classic mesoderm enhancer, which we know a fair bit about. And what she ended up finding again is that all of these changes were happening again only in the mesoderm. We were not getting any interesting ectopic patterns of expression. We looked across different time points in development. So in the end, it was kind of boring. And we kind of repeated these for a variety of different enhancers, shown here, for example, for this twist enhancer, this row enhancer, where, again, the identity is not really important. This is actually much just very early in the embryo, but it's the ball of cells. And again, we thought we knew a fair bit about the enhancer structure, because these are ones I've worked on extensively during my PhD work. And now focusing again on ectoderm, mesoderm, or endoderm, what we found now by going through, and this is another talented postdoc in the group, is that by mutating this one as normally a mesoderm, we never were able to turn it on, for instance, in the ectoderm or in the endodermal tissue. It was very, very limited. Similar to this stripe, this is actually the presentive neurogenic ectoderm, right? So it's going to become the nervous system. And as we were modulating that from the mutational perspective, again, all the changes were happening exclusively in that tissue type, right? So this is a pretty classic signature now for these different enhancers we're looking at, right? So these are really deeply constrained. And so for us, then, we were curious, how does evolution happen at all, right? Because this is kind of just modulating the levels up and down. So then we became much more interested about de novo evolution. So if you take different bits of DNA, maybe the genome is building these different expression patterns by just sampling sequence space outside of these elements. So we were curious as how easy it is to actually generate these different patterns of expression, you know, kind of a priori in the genome. And this is a lot of work that originally Kirsten did, was pushed by many people in the group. And really what we did here is the same pipeline, but in this case, we're just putting totally random DNA, right? So very unbiased, and we just wanted to see what was going to happen. And for us at the time, this was very, very striking, because what we found in this case is about 36% of these were driving expression somewhere in development, which we did not expect going in. I thought it'd be very, very low compared to what we were seeing here. So you can see there's different kind of aspects of expression. Some will turn in the gut, some will turn in the different stripes, some are very broadly expressed. So again, we have a lot of these different expression patterns. And in some cases, we could actually see, for example, it was actually reducing the kind of leaky expression we'd have from the native construct, right? So again, very easy to kind of carve out these expressions, at least from this standpoint. And by going into these, it became very clear very quickly, if you just do this motif analysis, that there's common motifs that would fall out from this, such as this GATA E motif. Every single time we had one of these motifs, we would turn on in the gut. And you have other examples of another classic pioneer factor known as grainy head, where most of the time, it's actually higher than 80%, that's incorrect, but most of the time, if you have this motif in your enhancer, you're going to turn on somewhere in that ectodermal tissue, right? And the reason we were interested in about this is because these are, again, key motifs that are associated with developmental expression. And as many of you may know, what these are functioning as is pioneer site or factors, right? So they will go into DNA, open that region up, and then downstream, we think after that's happening, any of the other random DNA there can might just pull in these different factors, which are going to kind of modulate the levels of expression downstream, right? So we want to see really if these are pioneer factors regulating these elements. And then we did this now by biasing that library with these different sites for two of these very classic pioneer factors in Drosophila. So one of these is actually known as Zelda, which is expressed very early in development as well as late in the ectoderm here. So we made these random libraries again, biasing in those motifs. What we found very quickly again is that in this case, over 80% of these were driving expression somewhere in development. Right? So this really kind of pushed these systems now towards driving these expression patterns. And I also want to point out, when you do these type of approaches, these are not subtle, small amounts. If you actually compare that to that wild type enhancer, you can see that some are actually driving much higher levels of expression. And again, we kind of repeated this now as grainy head. And in this case, we get this number right here, which is very rare for me, because every single one of these, if we put in one of these strong motifs, drove expression somewhere in development. And you, again, you can see that there's commonalities to the expression patterns, but overall, you do get some of these different subtleties, we think, from this neighboring sequence. So to go all the way back to the original observation here, we really do think that a lot of these existing elements are functionally constrained, right? Because what I'm showing you here is actually examples where these predominantly come from de novo motifs, right? That's what they were pulling out. So we think a lot of this is coming now from this perspective. And by doing these large-scale libraries, we think we can pull out these type of general principles. And again, these other ones like placenta, this is not driven by enhancer mutations typically. This is through transposons, right? A very rapid way to kind of go through and change expression patterns. Similar, these are both examples of breaking enhancers, right? So they're actually getting phenotypical change now through actually just reducing or eliminating those enhancers entirely, right? So again, I think really then that these new motifs are pushing the way these systems are evolving. And so you can actually do it then by, you can get phenotypical evolution by actually breaking them. So to kind of conclude a lot of this, really going back to this observation, we were very curious at this point how any of these are going to evolve, period, in this case, right? So this is not very simple for us. Is, you know, why is this enhancer so sensitive? And then really, how could it evolve at all? So at this point, I want to really point out that Noah took over this project from Tim, one of the first graduate students in the group. And focusing on this, we were curious maybe that we just took, by random sampling, we're missing the possible paths of evolution. Right, so we wanted to do a full reconstruction then between melanogaster and simulans, a very closely species, it diverged about 5 million years ago, which has just a small handful of change. And so what Noah ended up doing is that she actually did an entire ancestral reconstruction of every possible variant across that entire landscape. Right, so this is a major amount of work actually. And what you can see very quickly is we have extensive amounts of, you know, differences between these. Right, so if you compare melanogaster all the way to simulans, there's not necessarily a very clear path for, through this. And what I mean by that more concretely, you can see that as you go through this from, for example, looking at nuclear density, many of these different ways very quickly will drop down or in some cases go up. So we see examples of, in this case, extensive epistasis. We see a lot of these very rugged landscapes. And what we mean by that, for example, of epistasis is, in this case, we have one enhancer, which you mutate it here, it goes down. Another possible avenue, mutate it, goes down. You put those two together and it actually goes up, right? So again, we see many, many examples of this. Right, so here again, you can see that they're very, very low, but now you put them together and it's very high, right? So we can't explain all this yet functionally, but again, from an evolutionary perspective, it's showing us how difficult some of these might be to evolve. And so again, one of the things we started exploring was that really in nature, if you go out and sample, you don't typically have two of the same allele. You have one from the maternal side and the paternal side. So maybe we're being a bit simplistic and a bit stupid in the way we're approaching these. So we were curious about then is what happens if we mix these alleles? What happens? So again, we took one of the worst trajectories going through these different relationships here. And what Noah then did is cross them together. And what you can see, which was rather striking to us, is that those are completely normalized. Right, this is not 50% or does anything like that. These go back to wild type levels of expression through these. And to kind of demonstrate that here, this is one of these variants which, you know, it might look low here, but this is actually non-existent. But now if you take the wild type and you cross it with this, again, it's completely normalized at this point. Right, so for us, we were really curious about this could be a way to really kind of even out these landscapes and how you could evolve as a system. And so again, to put this in another perspective, going back to Waddington landscape, oftentimes, all the experiments we've been doing are comparing a wild type to one of these different enhancers here, right? But again, evolution is not going to make a jump in two alleles are just going to break typically, right? It's probably going to take a path that's much more like this, where now you can sample these different heterozygotes. So we're curious then about if this is really the way you can push this robustness and evolvability. And to really kind of make this point home, here I'm looking at an example where it's stage 15. This enhancer is this is the wild type enhancer. You go to stage later, it's even higher. But now this is another mutant where early on, it will basically break all that normal expression patterns. You let it develop further and actually does the opposite where it's overexpressed. But what's now what's interesting, if you take those hets together, these are completely normalized. So not only are you increasing expression where you normally reduce it, but now you're actually buffering it down. Right, so to us, this is actually quite exciting. We could also see this in another example for that wing one I pointed out earlier, where now you'd have this wild type enhancer. This mutant right here, you can see when you have the het or the homozygotic mutant, you can see that you turn on nicely in the wing discs, but it comes at a cost of destabilizing normal expression. But now you cross these together, the normal aspects of expression, you can actually quantify it here. It's almost exactly the same as wild type. But what's interesting in this case is that the wing and halter disc is actually slightly different. Now it actually is very dose dependent. So why this is interesting for us is, again, we have these tissue specific effects, but the robustness and the novel expression you really kind of gain by putting these in this heterozygote condition. So to kind of keep pushing the talk forward so I don't run out of time, we were curious then about going back to what happens as a rather fly specific thing. But what I want to point out as we go further on, we think is a very, very general feature. Where in the flies, you kind of bias it. We have this phenomenon as transvection, where you can actually push these enhancer to turn on a promoter across these different chromosomes. So we're curious about these hubs might be facilitating this. And the reason we've been interested in hubs for a long time, and I'm not going to go through all the details here, but we have a lot of these different data we've been collecting over the years. This is actually single molecule imaging in the nuclei. And what you can see is you get these little, each one of these is a nucleus, and you get these clouds of molecules where if you actually look at the videos here across these frame mates and focus in these regions, you can see these molecules will come in, they'll go away, they'll come in, and you get these clusters kind of coming and going very, very quickly, right? So again, this is imaging showing like kind of what's happening here. You could slow it down again and see these clusters. And we know now if you go into these clusters, measure where transcription is actually happening for Shaven Baby, it's happening right at some of these peaks of where the intensity is, right? So it's happening at these hubs. So we were curious then if this could be a way to kind of actually, these hubs could smooth out again and tell us what's happening between these different alleles. So what we actually found in this case is that we want to take the most extreme edge where we totally remove that enhancer to see if it could still turn on the promoter. And it turns out it's yes. So you can see that these are actually co-localized. We can see that's very strong for the empty vector. So the wild type enhancer is turning on this empty vector. It doesn't have an enhancer. But I want to point out this is extremely rare. So you don't have two enhancers. It's very, very hard to do this. We typically get one or two per embryo. But when it's happening, it is right inside one of these clusters where you measure the level of UBX. So you can see there are two alleles are interacting. It's within one of these little cluster environments like this. And then we can actually go further and start to look at now, you know, across this other tissue type where we had that one that's turning on the wing and halter. Here it's also in the ventral zone. And you can see that pretty much every time in this region down here, it's turning on, you get this co-expression. So they're both co-firing together. This is actually different though if you look at the wing and halter where they're not doing that. There's something kind of interesting happening there which we haven't really figured out fully. But now to take us a little further, what you can see in those regions in the ventral zone where this enhancer that's, you know, been weakened by these mutations, what we see now again, it's been stabilized. And every time we go into those regions where they're being co-expressed, again, you can see both are firing. We have high levels of UBX. You can see that very high level of the UBX locally. And I have to, again, thank NOAA because there's actually a huge amount of effort to really nail these down, these kind of high-resolution images. And again, you can see this really clearly here that when the wild-type enhancer is on and this one's turning on, the levels go up across these axes. This is happening very significantly. You get these high levels of local UBX, right? So this is not just a one-off observation. This is very consistent across these embryos. So we then think that what's happening again is that you get these very rugged paths for evolution, right? So they're very sensitive to a lot of this. But we think really what's happening is by having these different heterozygote conditions, it allows you to kind of sample a bit more space across these genome before you potentially will start to select on different features. Right, so again, we think this is actually promoting its robustness and evolvability. And the last few minutes before I walk away, I'll just talk about some of the future directions that we're very, very excited about. In this case, really, you know, I started the talk saying I want to describe this, But to me, it's been quite depressing because I, you know a fairly little about what's going on here and why we see certain patterns, which I don't have time to go into right here. So a lot of what we've been doing right now is to get a much larger framework to explore this space. And I really want to thank James, who's been doing this, as well as a talented postdoc, another engineer in the group. So a lot of what we've been doing with James is he did a lot of this at Genalia for us. It's through these ways where what I'm showing you here is a cycle HCR embryo, because what you can do here is each one of these is actually going to be a segmented nuclei. So you can go out and look inside that nuclei. And in this case, we looked at around 120 genes. So basically everything that's ever been known about the segmentation network or anything that might feed into Shaven Baby. And what's really kind of powerful about these techniques is you can see that each one of these is actually a nucleus you pull out of there. So in this case, I think we have 33,000 nuclei. And across each of those nuclei, again, you can reproject it back into the embryos, right? And we have, again, for 120 genes for each one of those 33,000 nuclei now. So it's a whole entire new way for us to start to sample this landscape of the embryos. And on top of that, you know, I think this is going to be a major game changer, at least for our group, very selfishly, because what we can start to do now is take the data from our libraries that generated this type of thing. We can take the heaps of the single cell data, all the ATAC-seq data, and now you can actually reproject and map all of these into these different embryos. So this is a very active process, but this is us showing an example of some of these, because now we can start to really connect changes here at the gene level to different changes that might be responding now to these very cell type specific ways back to the embryos to really understand how these might be changing as you mutate them across the spatial landscape of the embryo. So again, very much a work in progress. We're very excited about this. So if anybody wants any feedback, and this is a good one to put up at the end of the talk because it's good for beer discussion going forward. Because again, for a developmental biologist, I think this kind of tech is going to be a game changer for us. And with that, I will stop and just thank a huge number of people who helped a lot of these efforts. This is the current group right here. I'll stop and see if there's any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Justin. Let me start the question. You, as a readout, you use mostly stripes.
Yeah.
Flies. And as you know, they are very recent invention in Diptera, in fact. In a rather recent past, the stripes were produced in a very different manner. The segments were produced in a sequential addition, and so on. No gap genes, no maternal information, and so on. So the question is, this maximal constraint in not going from one gem layer to the other gem layer, do you think it is something that appeared at the time of this kind of stripe formation, or is something inherited from a short gem and insects?
Yeah, it's a very good observation. So I would say some of this might go back to your original question, I forget whose talk it was, saying if you're too strong of an enhancer, does that come at a cost? Because I think that you notice that there's actually a difference between the early embryonic enhancers, which are a bit more plastic. They're not just breaking everything, right? They're more tunable. I think that these are actually biased towards, if you have mutations, it's better to actually just reduce expression. Right, because if you have Shaven Baby misexpressed, you're going to turn it into a trichome. You don't want that happening in some random cell type.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.